Our call to worship is from the Unitarian poet E.E. Cummings. I thank you, God, for most this amazing day, for the leaping greenly spirit of trees, and a blue, true dream of sky, and for everything which is natural, which is infinite, which is yes. I, who have died, am alive again today, and this is the sun's birthday. This is the birthday of life and of love and wings and of the gay, great, happening, illimitably earth. How should tasting, touching, hearing, seeing, breathing, any lifted from the know of all nothing, human merely being, doubt unimaginable you? Now the ears of my ears awake, and now the eyes of my eyes are open. This morning I want to share with you what is one of my favorite Easter stories. There once was a Velveteen Rabbit who in the beginning was very splendid. He was fat and bunchy like a rabbit should be, and his coat was beautiful, and he had wonderful whiskers. He lived in a toy closet in a boy's room with other toys. Many were more expensive, and they snubbed him. Some were mechanical toys who thought they were superior. And then there were the toys who were models of real things, like boats. The rabbit couldn't claim to be a model of anything because he didn't know that real rabbits existed. The only toy that was kind to him was the skin horse. The skin horse had lived in the nursery longer than any of the others. His coat had bald patches and most of his hair had been pulled out. But he was very wise and knew about nursery magic. One day the rabbit asked the skin horse, "What is real? Does it mean having things that buzz inside you or having a stick-out handle?" "Real isn't how you are made," said the skin horse. "It's a thing that happens to you. When a child loves you for a long time, not just to play with, but really loves you, then you become real. It happens a little at a time. When you are real, you don't mind being hurt. Generally, by the time you are real, most of your hair has been loved off, and your eyes drop out and you get shabby. But once you're real, you can't be ugly, except to people who don't understand." "Are you real?" asked the rabbit. The skin horse smiled. "Many years ago, the boy's uncle made me real, and once you're real, you can't become unreal again." One night, the little boy took the Velveteen Rabbit to bed with him. Thereafter, the rabbit slept with the boy every night. The boy hugged him very tight, and sometimes even rolled over him. At first, it was a little uncomfortable, but soon the rabbit grew to like it. He and the boy spent hours together. The boy took him in the garden and gave him a ride in the wheelbarrow and even made a nest for him. The rabbit was so happy that he never noticed how shabby he was getting. Once when the boy was called suddenly, he left the rabbit in the garden. But that night he couldn't go to sleep without his bunny. So Nana, who took care of the boy, had to go out in the garden with a candle to look for the bunny. She finally found him dirty and wet. When she got back to the boy, she said, "My, such fuss over a toy." But the boy said, "You mustn't say that. He isn't a toy. He's real." When the rabbit heard this, he was very happy. He remembered what the skin horse said and knew that the nursery magic had happened to him. For a long time, the boy and the bunny did everything together. The boy loved him so much that he loved off his whiskers and the pink came off his nose and he even began to lose his shape. He didn't even look like a rabbit anymore, except to the boy who thought he was beautiful. But one day, the boy became very ill. And all during his sickness, the rabbit stayed close to him in bed. Strange people came and went from the little boy's room, and the rabbit hid under the covers because he was afraid someone might take him away and he knew that the little boy needed him. The boy was too ill to play, but the rabbit looked forward to the time when the boy would be well again. He made all sorts of plans about what they would do, and he crept up to the boy's pillow and whispered them in his ear. The boy got better, and his family said they were going to take him to the sea. The rabbit was excited about going to the sea with the boy, but the doctor told Nana that all the toys in the nursery had to be burned because they were full of germs from the boy's illness. So along with all the other toys, the rabbit was carried out to the rubbish. The boy was so excited about getting better and going to the sea, he didn't even notice the rabbit had been taken away. That night, the rabbit peeked his nose out of the trash. He was cold and missed his night's bed, and he was very sad. He remembered how wonderful it was when the boy made him real, but he wondered, of what use was it to be loved and lose one's beauty and become real if it ends like this? And then a real tear trickled down the rabbit's shabby velvet nose and fell on the ground. And then a strange thing happened. Where the tear had fallen, a beautiful flower grew. It was so beautiful the rabbit forgot to cry. He just watched, and out of the beautiful flower stepped a fairy. "Little rabbit," she said, "I'm the nursery magic fairy. I take care of all the things that children have loved. When they are old and worn and the children don't need them anymore, I take them away with me and turn them into real." "Wasn't I real before?" asked the rabbit. "You were real to the boy," said the fairy, "because he loved you. Now you shall be real forever." She held the rabbit in her arms and flew with him into the woods where the rabbits that hopped and jumped in the garden lived. She told them, "You must be kind to him and teach him all the things he needs to know in rabbit land, because he's going to live with you forever." She kissed the rabbit and put him down and told him to run and play. He was surprised to find that he now had real hind legs, and he leaped for joy. He was a real rabbit, at last at home with other rabbits. Well, autumn came and winter passed, and the next spring, the now healthy boy went out to play in the woods behind the house. And while he was playing, two bunnies came near and peeped at him. The eyes and nose and spots on one of them looked familiar, and the boy thought, "Why, he looks just like my bunny that was lost when I was sick." But he never knew. It really was his own bunny, come back to look at the child who had helped to make him real.
Thank you.
Our first reading this morning comes from the 16th chapter of the Gospel of Mark. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James, and Salome bought spices so that they might go and anoint him. And very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb. They had been saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance to the tomb?" When they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had already been rolled back. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe, sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. But he said to them, "Do not be alarmed. You are looking for Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has been raised. He's not here. Look, there is the place they laid him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter that he is going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." So they went out and fled from the tomb, for terror and amazement had seized them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid.
This is a reading called The Growing Edge by Howard Thurman. In the Christian faith, wisdom places the central moment of high celebration to coincide with the coming of spring, the creative season when life abounds on every hand. After the crucifixion, one of the disciples said, "Well, I'm going fishing." The event outside the city wall seemed to have exhausted the possibility of life and of God, to have made him who died on the cross its prisoner. Later, these disciples had another kind of experience that completely changed their feelings. Whether or not the biblical description of what happened commends itself to the modern mind is not basic to the experience. They now felt that he who died on the cross was not the prisoner of the event of the cross. That is, they suggested that theirs was an example of universally valid insight. There is inherent in the nature of life what I call the growing edge. We see it in nature. Always vitality seems to be nestled within the heart of a dying plant. A kind of oak tree comes to mind. You've seen it. The leaves turn yellow and die, but they stay on the tree all winter. The wind, the storm, the sleet, the snow, nothing is able to dislodge these leaves from the apparently dead branches. The business of the tree during the long winter is to hold on to these dead leaves. Then there begins stirring deep within the heart of the tree, an expression of its life. Its function is no longer that of holding on to dead leaves. It turns them loose. They fall off. In their places, buds begin to come. What wind, storm, hail, sleet, ice could not do during the long winter now come to pass very quietly because of the vitality inherent in the tree. No expression of life exhausts life. At the time when the slaves in America were without any excuse for hope and they could see nothing before them but the long, interminable cotton rows and the fierce sun and the lash of the overseer, what did they do? They declared that God was not through. They said, "We cannot be prisoners of this event. We must not scale back our hopes and our dreams and our yearnings to the level of the events of our lives." So they lived through the tragic moment until at last they came out the other side, saluting the fulfillment of their hopes and their faith, which had never been imprisoned by the event itself. In private life, the same things obtain. So long as you recognize that no event of your life, whatever its character, can imprison you, you will not scale down your aspirations to the level of the facts to the present situation. You will let what rises on the horizon inform the event with which you are wrestling until at last the event itself begins to open up, to yield, to break down, to disintegrate, until the relentless pressure of the sum force which transcends the event and tutors and informs it. This is what the resurrection is all about.
Not long ago, I was talking with a member of this church, and she told me that she'd grown up a Unitarian Universalist, and her family regularly attended church. They were there almost every Sunday except Easter. They didn't go on Easter because her father found the Easter story a difficult one. Many of us are not quite sure what to do with the Easter story, and therefore sometimes it may be tempting to avoid it. By the way, if you've ever had that feeling, you're in good company. Remember those three women in the first reading? Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome? They too didn't know what to make of the story, and they fled in terror when they encountered the Easter message. Well, folks, it is a difficult story, but I'm glad you're here, and hopefully you won't be fleeing from the church as we explore its meaning this morning. I think it's an extremely important story for all of us. It's not just a story about what happened or might have happened on a hillside outside of Jerusalem 200 years ago. It's a story, it's our story, or at least it's a story that's available to every one of us. Easter reminds us that there is a power available to us, even in the darkest time, that can move us to new life. It reminds us that we can move beyond the brokenness of our life to wholeness, beyond sadness to joy. It's a story we cannot hear too often, for in it is found the path from despair to new life. The late Unitarian Universalist minister Max Kutz put it this way: in us are written the new versions of the old Easter story, the empty tomb, the renewal. We're at least part of what that ancient myth can mean. So what about those Easter stories written in our lives? Well, they all start with difficult times. For some, it may be the death of a loved one, a serious medical diagnosis, the loss of a job, loss of financial security, depression, or other mental illness. These are surely some of the tombs in which we can find ourselves. There are other things in our lives that also can imprison us as surely as the heavy stone did Jesus. Things like abusive relationships, lack of acceptance, lack of self-acceptance, things like alcohol or substance abuse, to name just a few. It might be the tomb of despair or anger or grief. So many things can have a death-like destructive hold on us, preventing us from enjoying life's fullness. So many things can prevent us from becoming real, like the Velveteen Rabbit did, from moving forward, like the followers of Jesus did. The literal story of the resurrection may be something that is a deep part of your faith, or it may not resonate with you at all. And it may sound strange for me to say, but whether or not you find the literal story to be true, the Easter promise I'm speaking about this morning is still critical to your life. You don't have to wait until you die to realize an Easter promise. The Easter promise is a critical part of our lives every day. I don't really know what happened on that first Easter. I don't know what physical events those disciples witnessed. But I think I do understand the very human emotional experience. And each year as I grow in my ministry, it becomes ever more clear to me that it is from the humanness of those first Christians that we learn the power and importance of Easter's promise in our lives. So I'd like to return to that first Easter for a moment. The women, you heard in Mark's gospel, were ready to put a respectful ending to Jesus' life, ready to anoint him, wrap his body, and seal him in a tomb forever as a final act of love for him. It was over, and their love for him made their pain great. When they were confronted by the possibility that at some level the story was not over, they fled in terror and said nothing to anyone. They loved the man who was crucified, and he embodied all their hopes, and those hopes had died with him on the cross. They were not ready for life to go on. They fled in terror, afraid to even speak of the possibility of resurrection, the possibility that at some level Jesus continued to be with them. In the second reading, Howard Thurman reminds us how the men who followed Jesus reacted at the crucifixion. They too loved him, so much that most of them could not even bear to be with him at the end. As surely what must have seemed to them like the defeat of all their dreams. When the times got rough, they fled, trying to return to their former lives as fishermen. They tried to deny their time with Jesus and carry on with their life as if it had never existed. And isn't that the same way many of us react when we're having difficult times? We too become frightened and afraid even to mention our suffering to others. Sometimes we play a game with ourselves. We put the emphasis on functioning, and we try to block out the experience entirely and live as if nothing happened. We think that by not speaking of our pain, not engaging the difficult situation of our lives, denying them, avoiding them, avoiding anything that brings them to mind, that we'll get through it. But what we often find is that we are instead trapped, living in a tomb, if you will, imprisoned by the events of our lives. The Easter journey from out of the tomb of brokenness and despair to a place of new hope is a challenging spiritual journey. It takes time. I know when a loss is fresh, when pain is intense, sometimes we do have to just stay in the safety of the dark tomb for a while. But a cold tomb is no place to stay for very long. Ultimately, the stone holding us in our private tombs can yield, but it will require some effort and some help as well. I believe that there's a powerful catalyst that helps this happen, something that may even cause the Easter transformation in us to take place. To explore that, I want to go back to the two stories I shared with you this morning, the biblical Easter story and the story of the Velveteen Rabbit. They're both stories about the promise of new life. The promise is that we can be made whole, we can be made real. But both stories are also about something else. They are great love stories. Love is the Easter catalyst that can bring about the reaction in us, that can move us from the cold tomb to embracing a promise of new life. The story of the Velveteen Rabbit is a very special one for me. I never get through it without a lump in my throat. But I see it as just another way of telling the Easter story. It's like the biblical account in so many ways. They're both about loss and suffering. They're both about change. But more than that, they are stories of great hope. Hope in the transformative power of love. A love that can bring us out of despair. A love that is stronger than any other force in our lives, even death. Strangely, it is in our suffering and hurting and the losses we face in life that we often really learn about that love. Love makes us vulnerable. Like it did on the rabbit, it takes its toll on us. It wears off our fur and can make us pretty shabby. It will always involve loss and hurt, but it also opens us up to the possibility of new life. Loving ourselves, loving others, being willing to receive the love that others offer to us, these are the risks one must take to realize the promise of new life. As it did for Jesus' followers and for the Velveteen Rabbit, the love that can inspire us and give us great joy can also bring us pain. Love makes us cry, like it did the poor Velveteen Rabbit when he was thrown out into the trash. Now, I don't really anticipate that when my tears fall, a beautiful flower will spring up and a fairy will jump up and restore me and make me immortal. But you know, I don't totally dismiss the idea either. Because tears of love do change us. Like it did for the Velveteen Rabbit, we too experience something wonderful when we love and when we are loved. What this classic children's story tells us is that it is in the way we love others and in the love we receive that we are able to act on the promise of new life, and that love has the power to help us triumph over all the obstacles of our lives. This week I was thinking back on something that happened to me many years ago. It was on my very first day as a hospital chaplain. It was while I was being given a tour of the floors to which I was to be assigned, I was told by a nurse on one of those floors that a 41-year-old Latino woman who was in her final stages with AIDS was not expected to live long and that the family was having a very difficult time. The nurses were beside themselves because the only family member present was a 14-year-old streetwise son who did not fully understand how sick his mother was. And I said I'd stop back to the floor as soon as the tour was complete. But I was paged to come sooner than that. And I left the tour and went to the room. And outside the room, I found one of those contact precaution signs. And I tried to remember what I just learned that I was supposed to do for that level of precaution. But thank goodness the nurses were there, and they were so relieved to see me that they literally dressed me in a gown and gloves and mask. I could already hear hysterical sounds in the room, and I was literally scared. I was desperately trying to get any information I could about the family from the nurse that might help me. Religion, if any, maybe Pentecostal, maybe Catholic, no affiliation on the chart. And before I could ask another question, the nurse said, "There's very little time. We really need your help with her son." So I went into the room, and the son was sobbing and screaming, "Don't die. You can't die." And then he yelled at me, "Pray for her." So I did. And I tried to touch as many theological bases as I could, hoping I would hit something that would resonate. In less than 15 minutes, she was dead, and I was with a grief-stricken teenage boy sitting beside his mother's bedside sobbing. I said very little, but soon I could feel that he was collecting himself. And then he spoke slowly and clearly, and I can still hear his words. "She is not gone. She's not dead. I still love her." And with that newfound strength, he was able to leave the room and go make calls to his relatives. Of course, it was only the beginning of a tough journey for this teenage boy. But it was the Easter story playing out again. The story that love is stronger than death. That love triumphs. Easter is the greatest story of hope and of love and the connection between them. It proclaims a great promise to us all. No matter how low of a point we're at in life, no matter how long we've been in the tomb of despair or grief, there's a way out. It tells us something more is waiting for us. To move us from the tomb to Easter is no easy task. It takes some effort and some courage. But there's more. Love is the catalyst. It was the love of the man and the message, even with all its pain, that gave the disciples new hope and sent them forth to continue Jesus' work. It was the love of the boy that first made the rabbit real, and the tears of love the rabbit shed that made the transformation possible in that story. And it was the love that the teenage boy had for his mom that kept her alive in his heart and helped him to move on with his life. Love is the Easter gift we can and I hope will give to each other, especially to those who may be trapped in a cold tomb. Love can be the key with which we unlock our prison doors. In loving community, we are each other's catalyst. We can help each other move to the Easter experience that's so necessary in our lives. Every day, in ways large and small, the new version of the old story of Easter, the story of overcoming the seemingly impossible, of finding new life in seemingly dead places, the story of love triumphing over despair. Every day, these stories are written in us. Easter offers us the greatest promise for which we could ever ask, and love is the most powerful transformational force in the world. It is for these profound gifts that we sing our Alleluias of praise on this day of days.